Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio, and today's guest is Dale E. Winther, W6PDL. Our guest is Dale E. Winther. I hope I'm saying that right. Am I saying that right, Dale?
Yes.
W6PDL. He's our guest. I want to say welcome to QSO. And this fella here has got so many facets to his ham radio hobby and career that I don't even know where to start. I guess, you know, the best thing to do would be to start maybe at the very, very beginning when you first got into amateur radio. And how did you, I think you made a mention or a reference of being 6 years old. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I can start in my interest first in electronics. I was 6 years old, and this was in 1954. I was walking around in a field with an older kid, and I stumbled across a bread slicer variable condenser on the ground, in a junk pile. I picked it up and looked at it, and the kid told me, I said, "What does this do?" And the kid says, "This changes the station on your radio." And I looked at him in utter amazement. I rotated that thing. I looked at these blades. I says, "They're not touching anything. They're not mechanically connected. How can that change a station on a radio?" And with my first inclination, there was something I needed to understand. So I took it home with me, and I studied it, and just kind of scratched my head for a while. And then my father came home with our very first television set, the black and white TV set. And he turned it on, and there were these pictures coming out of the TV set. And I looked at him and says, "Well, where's the projector?" And he says, "Oh, no, there's no projector." He says, "Oh, come on, Dad. There has to be a projector inside that box." He says, "No, the pictures are sent invisibly through the air into that antenna up there, and they come down this wire, and somehow it gets turned into a picture." And I was just dumbstruck as a child. I can still remember the amazement. Well, my father was not very happy. When he went to work one day, and I decided to take his television set apart to find the projector. I was smart enough to write down. Remember, in the old tube TVs and everything, they had they told you what tube went in what socket, and that's so there was a chart. Thank God for cheater cords, because I pulled the back of that thing off of there, and I just started pulling out tubes. But I wrote down where every one of them went. I didn't want to get in trouble, and I started taking out the tubes and examining the tubes and trying to understand what else. I don't understand it. Put all the tubes back. Well, I didn't put them all. I had about half put back before my dad came home, and you should have heard him scream. His very first TV, and it was in pieces on the floor. And I was crying. I said, "Well, Daddy, I'll put it all back together. I will. I know how to do it." And by golly, I did. And that was my first introduction to between that and the variable capacitor into what the future held for me in electronics. My curiosity about electronics.
That's an amazing story. You know, Ronnie Millsap tells a story about taking a radio apart. Oh boy, the same way when his uncle came home, boy, did he get heck for it. So you have something very much in common with WB4KCG, Ronnie Millsap here in Nashville, because that's exactly what he did when he was young. So let's talk a little bit about the first time you ever heard the term ham radio.
Well, here's how we get into that. First of all, my father had one of these in the 50s, one of these Webcore tape recorders with the magic eye level indicator on it and the reel-to-reel tape recorder. And I used to make believe I was a radio announcer. And I'd put on a tape, and I made up a call sign, KZZW, and I would even get commercials. And I still remember I went down to the local Western auto store, and they had these 1.5-volt batteries called, and it was Wizard Battery, and so I made them my sponsor. And this is KZZW, sponsored by Wizard Battery. You can pick them up at any Western Auto Store. As a kid, I was about 11 years old or 10 years old. Thought that was really fascinating. And then when I was somewhere in that age range, I had a bicycle accident. I had fallen off my bike. I loved black licorice, and I decided to put some pop bottles in my bicycle basket and run the bottles up to the store and turn them in for money so I could buy some black licorice. But I had too many bottles to return, and I was driving my bicycle without handlebars. I hit a bump, my wheel turned, I fell off the bike and landed on my elbows, cracked and shattered my left elbow, and there I lie in the middle of the street. Piece of glass had cut one of the arteries in my left hand, and blood was just spurting out over the place. And I remember at school saying, if you break a bone, do not move. You could make it worse. You could make it a compound fracture. So I just laid there, and there's blood shooting everywhere, and people standing around. And finally, an ambulance driver came and picked me up, and they went and fixed the problem. But I had talked to him a little bit about my fascination with this two-way radio in the ambulance. And so after all that was said and done, they took me over to the ambulance shop and showed me the big Motorola radio thing. And the guy explained to me there was such a thing as amateur radio. I said, really? Oh, I got to know more about this. Well, before I got that far along, I made my first crystal set, and I didn't have any luck with a cat whisker, so I went down to the local TV repair shop, and I said, could you sell me a diode so I could rectify this thing? And I think it was 25 cents, the repairman sold me a diode, and I used that plus wound a coil on some toilet paper roll and made my first crystal set with some 2,000 ohm headphones, connected it to we lived in Santa Paula at the time, a very small town, way far away from the nearest TV station, so you had to have like a 50-foot or 30 to 50-foot tower with an antenna on it. And I just clipped it onto that tower, and by God, I got three or four radio stations. That was it. I had to understand this amazing thing of radio, and one of these days I'm going to figure out what this ham radio was. So that kind of kicked me along until I moved, got into junior high school, and some of my friends were talking about it. But prior to doing that, I must tell you, when I was 12 or 13 years old, my fascination for electronics was overwhelming. We had a city dump, and at the city dump, they used to throw old radio and TV chassis away at the dump. So I would ride my bicycle over to the dump, and I would pick up radio chassis and tubes and circuits, take them home and take them apart, and try to build things out of them. So lo and behold, I had figured out from scratch how to build my first radio transmitter, and I did that because I discovered that if you had two AM radios in the same room, and if you turned the dial on one of them, it would cause a heterodyne on the station you were listening to on the other one. That was, you were tuning in the oscillator difference, the 455 kilohertz difference on the local oscillator. And I went in, and I went to the library to read up on it. I said, I got to understand what that was. And I thought, oh my gosh, that means that the radio that I was turning was radiating a signal. I said, I got to do something about that. Let me put an antenna on it. And I was surprised that it went quite a way. I said, okay, I got to rewire this radio. I got an old tube radio, rewired it so that I turned the receiver into a transmitter by using the loudspeaker as a microphone and going into a pentagrid converter tube using the secondary secondary grid to modulate it. And I was on the air with my first radio station at the age of 12.
That's cool. That's really cool. But let me ask you this question now. How much distance could you get out of that? Now, the other radio is obviously, it's an oscillator, you know. So did you rewire the radio so you were getting, you know, more power out of it than you would normally have, say, with an internal oscillator on the radio?
What I did, it was an old radio chassis, and it had one of the pentagrid converter tubes. I think it was a 6SK7 or Q7, one of those was the pentagrid converter at the time. And I figured if I put an antenna on the plate of the tube, I should be able to transmit a lot farther. And so I went up on the roof, and we had some excess guy wire from the last time the TV antenna was fixed, and I strung it up the roof and up to the TV antenna, and I probably had 30 or 40 feet of wire up in the air. And then I rode around on my bicycle with a portable radio that they were just coming out with the first transistor radios around that time, and I was driving around on my bike. I got a good mile out of it.
There you go. Yeah, I remember riding a bike with I had a phono oscillator that I'd got from Lafayette Radio Electronics, and it had a hot chassis, and I discovered what a hot chassis was. Let me plug that thing in. But anyways, I discovered that if I took the wire off of it, you know, and attached it to a wire that went outside, this is some of my early days of bootleg broadcasting, that I could wrap the wire around this phone line, I guess I want to call it, big, fat, round line that must have had a lot of wires inside of it and a sheath on the outside that I would assume was grounded. But if you wrap the wire around it and connected it up to the phono oscillator, then you could follow the phone lines for, oh my goodness, 5 miles. You know, you could hear that thing. And I could go in friends' houses and I'd say, okay, you know, bring your radio out here, the telephone, or we would alligator clip onto the phone dial, you know. that ground and bring the wire around and wrap it around the transistor radio once or something like that, and maybe coming in great. So that's it's amazing when you kind of wonder, how do you come across this stuff when you're a kid? You know, when you, I mean, because we don't really, I don't think, you probably like I was, I didn't have a whole lot of input, if that makes any sense.
No, my parents knew nothing about science, nothing about electronics. It was just something completely out of their domain. I just got curious and started playing with things.
So you made a jump, though, from that into amateur radio somehow. So how, what were the steps that were involved in getting you, you know, officially...
The jump from there, I think I was about 15 years old, and a friend of mine, we had moved from Santa Paula to Culver City, California, and it was going into junior high school, and he had told me I could buy this World War II surplus TCS, it was an Army tank receiver, and you could listen to some of the ham stuff. So I picked it up, I think it was for about $5 or $10, it was a surplus, it was literally a receiver from an old Army tank from World War II. Threw up an antenna and says, you know, I really got to do this. I really got to get into this stuff. And I put it off I was about 14 or 15 at the time. I kept putting it off because I didn't want to learn CW. I really didn't have any interest in CW. And that was an off-putting thing to me because technically I could pass the test. I was sure of that. And then what was coming through then was CB. And I thought, oh, my gosh, well, okay, it's a fun toy to play with. And so and this, remember, is in the mid-60s when... people only ran 5 watts, and nobody cussed on the air, and you only talked for 5 minutes, and everybody obeyed the rules. That's the only CB I ever used. For a few months, I played around with the CB, and I says, well, this is interesting, but I really do want to get my ham license. This is just not where I want to go. So I went off and finally got my knowledge license, which seemingly took forever to come in the mail. I still remember the absolute thrill when that ticket arrived in the mail. I think it was one of the more exciting days of my childhood. My gosh, I finally got my ham license in the mail. I can still remember that day.
You're listening to QSO. Our guest today, Dale E. Winther, W6PDL. We'll be right back right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the Skywave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the Skywave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a Skywave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a Skywave mentioning WTWW, you get a special bonus. You be sure and do that. Check out this little radio, the Skywave from the Sea Crane Company. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO, and it's all about ham radio. Let's return now to our guest, Dale E. Winther, W6PDL.
You know, I was going to say, we're going back to Citizens Band. We get into a conversation with so many of the guests on QSO about starting on Citizens Band, but it sounds like where you were at, it was relatively tame. Now, where I was in the Detroit area, the rules at that particular time were, and the call signs at that part, they originally started out like 19W, and there was some pretty strange Citizens Band call signs, but then they came out with three letters and four numbers. We used to make a joke of that, three letters and four numbers, based multiple.
Yeah, I was KFA 7721.
Oh, there you go. Okay, well, see, now the way it was channel 1 through 8. You could only talk to your own units that were, you know, licensed to your station.
Right.
And then channel 15 through 22, same applied. You could talk just to your units. But now channels 14 through, I'm sorry, channel 9 through 14, you could talk to other people with different call signs. And the same thing applied on channel 23. So, and it was 5 watts input to the final, maximum 4 watts out. Antenna could not be over 20 feet over the highest surface. So You could put it on a tower, 200 feet in the air, but on a roof, it could only be 2 feet over the roof. And I don't know what dictated that. But then you were limited to, you would not talk over 150 miles. That was the limit, and if you did that, you were in trouble.
Well, I remember that. Yeah.
And then it was 5 minutes off. Then if you were on for 5 minutes, you had to assume 5 minutes of quiet time where you couldn't talk. So 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off. And let's see, there was something else, and I can't think, a significant rule thing. Let's see, 5 on, 5 off. Well, anyways, 5 watts in, 4 watts out. 150 miles was the limit. Oh, I know what it was. And part of the rule said, no chit-chat.
Well, That was a bit too much for people to not chit-chat, I must say. Everybody kind of ignored that one. That was the first thing to get ignored. But we did obey the 5 minutes and all that sort of thing. And the mistake that the FCC did was granting that band on 11 meters. My God, when the skip came in, people just couldn't resist talking over 150 miles.
Well, in the Detroit area, nobody used their Citizens Band call letters. I would say very, very few did. The rest of them were handles. Everybody had a handle. And,
well, you know, I used to get QSL cards, the CBQSL cards. They would have those CBQSL cards with the CB call letters on them from around the country.
Yep, the people, and they'd put their CB calls right on the front. They wouldn't necessarily put their handle there, but a lot of them used handles, and of course, then they got into using amplifiers, and the sweep tube amplifier craze hit. We had that company out of Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, DNA, that made the Hornet and the Raider and the Maverick and the Phantom. And the Phantom, if you had a Phantom and you fired that thing up, you were wiping television sets out for about 12 square miles, I'll tell you.
I was completely out of there before anybody used an amplifier. I would be horrified to use an amplifier on CB or even use a bad word when I used it.
You know, I wish we could go back to that, because Citizens Band used to be, you know, it used to be a lot of fun because it was a local radio community on the air in a city or a town. And, you know, I'll tell you that, to some degree, that's even missing on 2 meters. I don't see the same kind of community. Those guys would get together and have these things called coffee breaks, and they'd raise money for some underprivileged families and things like that. And there was a camaraderie there that was really cool, you know, I don't know. I mean, I wish we had that kind of a community on 2 meters.
We did for a while. I got really active in the early 70s on when they first started putting 2 meter repeaters up in L.A. and got into a big Culver Park. Palisades Amateur Radio Club of Culver City was a big 2 meter club, and people were polite and nice, and it was a sense of community. It was really spectacular. It was even better than anything I'd ever experienced back in the early CB days.
Well, let me ask you a question. Tell us a little bit about your beginning equipment. What were you running back then?
I got to tell you that let's see, my first transmitter was completely homebrew. I made it out of one of the horizontal output tubes from a TV set, and for my novice. And I bought a key, but I built a chassis and I put in the tube socket and wired it up and got that thing on the air with a crystal and I was anxiously waiting for my novice license to arrive in the mail, and when it did, as I told you, I was highly excited. I didn't even have an antenna up yet. I ran up on the garage roof, my dad's garage roof, and put up a 15-meter dipole because the Army TCS receiver only went up to 12 megahertz. So I went over to Henry Radio and got an old Moro band converter. It was pretty cheap, and used that as a front end of this Army tank receiver, and that was my receiver. Because the Army Tech receiver had a BFO in it, so I could decode CW with it, and got on the air, and that was my first on the air experience. And then after a while, I said, "Well, you know, I'd like to get on 40 and do some other things." And somebody gave me some crystals, some of the large pronged crystals. So I wound up, I don't remember where I got it, but I think for $20, I got a Harvey Wells Bandmaster transmitter using an 807 final. That was supposed to do everything. It was supposed to be like, if it was 80 or 160, at least 80 meters through two. But it certainly would do the 40 meters that I wanted to get on and put that on the air. But then I suddenly discovered that my crystals weren't all on the novice band. I said, this is a problem. And then where I lived in Culver City, about 4 miles away, it was a company that ground crystals, radio crystals. So I hopped on my bicycle, and I rode over to the crystal grinder and said, I put this on the following frequency. I had a bunch of crystals, and I said, can you grind these frequencies? Can you trim them? And sure enough, the man put them into a machine with a frequency counter with this big Nixie tube readouts that they used to have, and he put them right on the frequency I wanted to be on, the novice frequencies. And he said, son, he says, I'm not going to charge you. He says, you just take those home and enjoy them. So I rode the 4 miles back to my house in Culver City, and I was happily on 40 meters.
There you go. Now, that's a story. That is a story. Can you believe that? A company in town, close to you, that actually did crystal production. That's That's amazing. That's amazing. And I know in the broadcast business, remember one time I took a crystal out of a commercial transmitter and took it out and ground it to try to get it to go where I wanted it to go. And I got it there, but I overshot just a little bit, you know. And,
oh, boy.
And so I tried to trim it and all that, but, you know, we just... It was kind of funny. That station was on the air during the day, but at night it had a strange whistle behind it because it was off frequency. It was heterodyning with an out-of-town station. So anyways, you know, they were the other station was on legally like we were. We were all legal. It's just that, you know, when you were off frequency just a little bit, that out-of-town signal comes squeaking through, you know. And
you'll get found out.
Yeah, you hear that. You hear that that beat. That was funny.
Well, but, you know, I was I love to toy with AM broadcast. It's just as a pirating, just for the fun of it. You know, I got that first start when I was up in Santa Paula, and here we were down in Culver City during my junior high years. I was about just before I got my ham license, and a couple of friends of mine from school wanted to compete on who could get the farthest signal out on the AM broadcast band with our pirate stations. And so I thought, well, I looked at all the technical parameters, and I knew about the 20 hertz, the stability factor, and I said, well, you know, if I make a heterodyne with an existing station, I might get caught by the FCC because they're going to hear the tone. So I bought a 1 megahertz calibration crystal and built a crystal oscillator and put it in an oven, believe it or not. And I said, no, this will be right on 1,000. The only station on there that I know of is Clear Channel KOMO in Seattle, and most of the time we don't hear it down here, and no one's going to know the difference. And if they do come on at night, I'm going to be zero-beated, so no one's going to discover that I'm a pirate. And as a kid, and that was kind of a kick, because I went all the trouble of making sure I maintained a complete zero-beat with KOMO. I'd wait for them to come on at night, and I zero-beat the oscillator, make sure there's no problem. I go on the air, and so then I built, I forget what I used for a tube transmitter, and I had a 50-foot vertical now. I was putting up an old converted TV mast on my parents' house, put that thing on there, and I was turning 16 because I just got my driver's license, and I wonder how far this goes, and I started, got in the car, and I put on a tape loop of some music, just put on a tape that I knew what it was. I live in Culver City to Hawthorne, which I think was about 7 or 8 miles away, and it was still coming in fine on my dad's car radio. I got scared. I really got frightened. Thought, I'm going to go to jail for this. I couldn't wait to get back home and put it off the air.
Oh, me. Yeah, I know that feeling very well. Yeah, you put some. When I was a kid, man, I used to do a lot of bootleg broadcasting, and That was always that feeling in your gut, you know, when you thought, I got everything just right. It's working perfectly now, you know. And you drive off on a bicycle or somebody takes you for a little ride in the car, you know, and all of a sudden you hear this thing. You're thinking, this is too far. This is too far.
Exactly what happened to me. I got clearer down to Hawthorne from Culver City. I says, it can't be possible. I can still hear this thing.
Oh, me. And then the funny part about it all is, after I went through that as a kid, and I won't tell the story because I've told it too many times, but I had a phone call from my son Matt, and him and David had been out in the yard working on an antenna, which I didn't really know what it was, but they called me up and said, tune in 106.7 or something like that. And I said, okay, I tuned it in. I think I was in Lebanon at the time, and there was music playing, but I thought it was another station. I didn't think it could possibly be what they were doing, you know. And I went through Lebanon, and I got on Highway 109, went over the bridge, started coming into Gallatin. And we lived in Hendersonville at the time. And, you know, as I could see then, after coming over the bridge, that this signal wasn't going away. So I pick up the phone, and I called them. I said, what are you playing? And they told me, and that's what was on the radio. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know. So I was never so glad for those two to get their ham tickets, you know. That kind of diverted some of that, although I think all that stays in us. I mean, like, if you and I and them got together and we were, you know, just having some fun on a Saturday night, I bet you any amount of money we'd wind up doing something that we really weren't supposed to do.
That's probably true. I had a lot of fun with that stuff.
So. Oh, it was fun, and it was also an education, too, and that's one thing I've often wondered, why they don't facilitate with a small portion of spectrum somewhere and call it amateur radio broadcast, you know, and let guys
build. That'd be great. Yeah.
You're listening to QSO. Our guest today, Dale E. Winther, W6PDL. We'll be right back right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20. For like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you get a special bonus. You be sure and do that. Check out this little radio, the SkyWave from the Sea Crane Company. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO, and it's all about ham radio. Let's return now to our guest, Dale E. Winther, W6PDL.
A friend of mine got really into pirate FM broadcasting when he was like in his 20s. He was really gutsy and nearly got caught a few times. But he was a good guy. He just had to do it for the fun of it.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's just in a lot of people. They just, they're broadcasters. Face it, that's just what they are, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, AE5AW, who used to be WB6OFG when we both lived in Culver City, we went to high school together. And he lived about a block away from me or so. But we used to compete on the broadcasting. He put a transmitter on the air, and he used a phone link to one of my other ham friends who really loved the audio side of things. And he had discs. He even had canned commercials, and he would run about a 2-hour broadcast. And AE5AW would put out about 100 watts on AM with full up commercials and everything. But what was even wilder is he used another phone line with a tie line. They had this special situation with the telephone company. If you called two different numbers, they would automatically connect in the middle. Mm-hmm. It was for service technicians for the phone company, and he'd gotten a hold of that. So it wouldn't be traced directly to him. He put out the number of this tie line. So if you called this number, he could connect to it on this other telephone number and then take requests for music. Well, we were in Culver City, and he was getting requests from Hollywood, and he was getting requests from East L.A., and he began to realize if it's going that far, I'm in deep doo-doo. So he finally had to cut it out. But he was professional. It was just the idea that he had to be doing the broadcasting, and the other guy was doing a remote for his station on the other side of Culver City with the turntable and the commercials and everything. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and that's something else I noticed. Radio stations, they don't know how to do remotes anymore. I'll tell you what. When I lived in Michigan, there was a station out on the west side of Detroit, actually in Ypsilanti, and the call letters were WSDS. Actually, the station's still there. But they had a blue van, and the call letters plastered all over it. And this blue van, if you were facing the rear, there was a Sparta audio board in there. There were two turntables, two cart machines. It had a generator built into it, an RV-type air conditioner in the ceiling. And then there was a tower that you would fold. It folded over the roof of the van, but when you were on location, you turned the crank, it would straighten up, and then you would extend three sections of tower, and on the top was the Marty Yagi antenna. So you sat there in this little blue bus playing 45 RPM records and playing the commercials off a cart. And I'm telling you, people would come by, they'd want to see this. You know, it was a major attraction. They wanted to come by and they'd stand outside and sit there and just watch, you know. I mean, I've seen people stand outside the thing for an hour watching, you know. And but somehow we've lost that today. Broadcasting has become, people go out to do a remote and a broadcast with a cell phone. It's like, that's not a remote. I don't know what that is, but anyways.
That's kind of sad. Now, we had, during high school, all of my other friends were getting ham licenses in high school, and I was kind of dragging my feet a little bit because I didn't want to get the code up. But I got to tell you, within not much more than 30 days of getting that novice ticket, I hit my 13 words a minute, and I just gotten my driver's license, so I went down to the FCC field office in downtown Los Angeles and took the test and passed it on the first go-around. Boy, was I excited about that one. So this was like when I was 16, and I just gotten my driver's license. I could drive, and so all of my buddies, we all decided we were going to go mobile, so we went 160 mobile in our cars. Now, you can imagine what that looked like. We loved to talk to each other on the 160 at the time because we thought it was so close to the AM broadcast band, we could relate to it, you know, 1.6 to 1.8 megahertz. They're real close, and so we had a feel for it. I had on my car, I had a, my first car was a used 1958 Chevy, but this was in 1966, so it wasn't all that old, which, by the way, I got for $350.
Goodness.
Big V8 in it, and you could work on it. Quite a good car for a high school kid. And I mounted, cowl-mounted, a center-loaded 160-meter antenna on the back of that car. The tip of that antenna was 17 feet above the ground, which I understand is over the limit these days. But I used to take that car down to Henry Radio on Olympic Boulevard. Well, the 405 freeway at Olympic, sometimes I would go under the 405 freeway and scrape the freeway with my antenna. That's how tall that antenna was on that car. But I had an absolute ball with that. I think that people do not realize today, hams today who have never done 160 mobile, that it was the thing to take the place of repeaters. There were no repeaters then. But we could talk car to car all over Los Angeles on 160. It just worked. The ground wave propagation was truly an amazing experience.
Well, that's something. You know, that's something we've lost in the process, because I remember, you know, people running 80 and 160 back when I was a kid was pretty common. People did it all the time, you know, and they had these AM rigs in the car. I think Multi-LMAC made...
I had an IMAC AF60, Multi-LMAC AF67.
Okay, well, I was going to say, I think Multi-LMAC made some rigs like that, because I remember seeing them in cars. And,
oh, the AF67, yeah.
And guys talking on them, you know, having fun. Well, you know, I don't want to jump ahead too far, but where did you go from here? I mean, you at some point in time you got introduced to single sideband, and maybe that might be an interesting story.
Well, you remember I had the old Collins TCS Army tank receiver with a BFO in it, and it wasn't very stable. And I didn't have much money. I was a high school kid, and where in the world would I get the money for a sideband rig? I had to stick with old AM rigs I could either make or buy surplus like I did with the Harvey Wells Bandmaster. And so it was a time when the 40 meters, for example, was split up between sidebanders and AMers. There were like the upper portion of the phone band was AM, and below that was sideband, and never the twain shall mix. Because they both got in each other's nerves. Obviously, sidebanders couldn't stand all the heterodynes, and the AMers couldn't stand the Donald Duck sounds because nobody had a receiver good enough to keep a stable receive on it. So we decided that single sideband, since I could only afford AM, and I had to prefer AM, that single sideband was a scientific setback, and people called us the ancient motors. You get ancient motors and the scientific setback people. It was kind of the divide on 40-meter phone. But that's how it got. I think I got into the sideband, oh, gosh, it wasn't until the 70s. I think most of my early years of hamming was all AM, even mobile. Did you know, Ted, that my final year of high school, I actually had a Johnson Valiant in my 58 Chevy. Took up the whole right front of the car. Run a couple of hundred watts in my car, and that was an astonishing setup for the car.
How'd you come up with the various voltages you needed for that inside an automobile back then?
I had an aircraft dynamotor for the plate voltage. It put out 750 volts, and it was from a dynamotor that I wired with a starter solenoid to turn it on, connected to a horn relay that triggered the starter solenoid that turned the thing on. So you hit the push to talk, it would go clunk. The whole cowling of the front of the car would shiver. When I hit that motor, you just heard this big clunk, and then you hear this whirring sound as the dynamotor started to wind up to give me the B+. But then I also had, for the intermediate voltage in the circuit, I had another smaller dynamotor. And it was insulated from the chassis because I had to run it backwards to give me the minus voltage that I needed for biasing. And I had a third supply, which is a T supply, a little small transistorized supply that I'd run up. So I had three different power supplies just to run that transmitter in the car, but it was pretty wild. I used to take that to school, and I'd stop traffic because I'd hit that mic button. You'd hear the siren sound under the hood, and people would say, "What in the heck is that?" But it was a lot of fun.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I remember at one point in time, much to my mom's horror, going inside the alternator and wiring up, I think it was three wires we attached to the alternator internally, and then came out and connected that to a series of filament transformers that were hooked in series. coming out of the alternator, going into the low side of the filament transformers, and then coming out by tying the high sides together, and coming up with about 900 volts or something like that, you know. And I remember doing that, and I remember, you know, my mom was horrified because I had the car alternator all apart and wires going in and out and everything, but it worked. And a fellow in West Virginia was the one that told me how to do it. And his call sign was K8RXW. And his name's Ken Kiefer. He's still around, I believe. But anyways, Ken told me how to do that. He had done it, and so that's what I did. And it worked. And I must say, at that time, I didn't have the slightest idea what I was doing. I was just following instructions.
Oh, boy. Sometimes that does it for you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. If a person tells you, knows what they're doing, you're better off just following instructions, you know. But a Valiant, man, that's amazing to have that inside the vehicle. I mean,
it took up the whole right front seat of the car. It was bolted under the dash. If you've ever seen the Valiant, they are humongous. And people say, well, weren't you dating girls? I said, where'd you put the girls? I says, I wasn't dating yet. I was having too much fun with ham radio.
Yeah, well, you know, that'd be like having, I had a Globe Champ 300. I can only imagine that thing under the dash. But if you think about it, we had big radios back then. We had Drake TR4s and TR4Cs and Hallicrafters transceivers and stuff that all came with mobile supplies. I remember all the Heathkit stuff came with the mobile supplies, and the one that drifted so bad, the Ico 753.
Oh, tell me about that. That was the worst radio. That was my first sideband radio, by the way. That was a terrible experience.
Yeah, well, you know what? They were manageable, though. They really were. I mean, considering the price. I mean, I never bought a new one. I bought one used, and I built two of them in kit form for some other fellas, you know, and so I was familiar with the rig. So when I saw a used one, I picked it up. But you just kind of hang on to the dial and tune while they're talking, you know. But yeah, but it was cheap enough, though. Let me put it that way. When I was a kid, I couldn't afford a sideband rig.
Well, that was just it. Me neither. That was a lot. You know, at that time, I think Swan was the first to come out with a commercial sideband rig, and it cost more than my car.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, it would back then. That's absolutely right. Which, I'm trying to think. I remember the Swan 350 and the Swan 500, and there was a 270 or something like that. I don't know. And then later, of all things, they came up with Swan was making these CB radios. I think they called them Siltronics or something. And I'd seen those at some ham fest, and I thought, that's a strange look. You know, and then it dawned on me that it wasn't a ham radio. It was actually a ham rig that had been manufactured for Citizens Band, you know.
Oh, boy.
That was where the people would want to get in between the channels and above and below the band and all that kind of stuff. There was a lot of those out. I mean, I saw lots of them. I never had one that didn't want one, because by then I'd progressed into ham radio and didn't have any interest in anything like that. But
that was the thing. Once I got my ham license, I had absolutely zero interest in CB, and I was out of that before it ever became unmanageable.
Well, let me ask this question. Like today, where do you hang out at, and what do you do on amateur radio as far as on-air work, and what fascinates you now?
Well, I have a perpetual love for HF, but I can tell you other stories about the other bands, which I will do, because I've got quite a career of making repeaters and things like that. But my first and true love is HF, and I love, for example, if you were to look at my website at W6PDL on QRZ, you can see my Kia Soul. I spent a year experimenting with mobile antennas. It's a pretty small car, and I didn't want to put a mechanical tuned antenna coil that's mechanically tuned. I wanted to be able to mount it up high. So what I did is I started up with a 706 Mark IIG and an AH4 auto tuner, external auto tuner, right at the very back inside the car. Went through the sidewall, put on a ball and spring, and a 9-foot whip, and the first thing that happened is, because it got such a high voltage, it started arcing through the chassis of the car and shorted out inside the car, and I had to have the car taken apart. I had to take the back of the car apart three times to get around this high voltage arcing problem. So I went ahead and had a custom ball mount made by Jerry Breedlove, mounts, that made a custom mount for me to support the high voltage. He bored a bigger hole and put through a 50,000-volt wire, insulated wire, through the hole to the antenna tuner. And a 4-inch insulator above the ball and spring is connected at the top of that. And I've never had a problem since. Just remarkable. But the curious thing that I've done is after experimenting with the whip, I still was, you know, having the typical problems of being base loaded on 40 and below. And that was not exactly what I wanted to do. I wasn't getting out enough signal. So I went to put on the DX Engineering hot rods. Used a Hustler mount and the Hustler mast. At the top of the Hustler mast, they put in the hot rods to make a capacity hat. Then put a 6-foot whip on top of that, and lo and behold, I've got a push-to-talk to HF radio that works anywhere. I can go from, well, anywhere from 60 meters to 6, just push the button. So I spent months experimenting with different coils and all kinds of things. I like multiband, love multiband, and because I'm driving along, I don't want to stop and change coil taps or change coils. So that I'm very pleased with the outcome of that experimentation.
So in all of your working with antennas, especially mobile antennas, what have you learned about capacitive hats? I mean, did you have a chance to play a whole lot with those things, or have you made any determination as to how well they improve things, or do they at all?
I was absolutely shocked on the improvement, especially on 40 meters. I remember I started out with the classical age for the auto tuner with the 9-foot whip on the ball mount kind of a thing, in which I had, and it worked pretty good. I mean, I got good all-band performance. But still, what I do when I'm talking to somebody on the air to check performance is I compare S readings between what they give me and what I give them. You know, if they have the same power, regardless of who has what antenna, we should pretty much have the same signal strength because it's a two-way path. Should be matched regardless. And so if I'm hearing them at 10 over and they're hearing me at an S7, I've got a problem. Even if I'm on mobile, because it should kind of go both ways, all things being equal. So I was having a little bit of unhappiness with the 40 meters. And as you know, when you're running base load on a 40, it's not ideal on 40 meters. And so I did the fluorescent light tube experiment. I said, okay, where are we picking off this energy? And you could see it light up really good down by the ball. And when you got up the whip, there was nothing. I couldn't find any voltage up there. I said, well, how do I fix that? And so I said, I'll put on this capacity hat. And I was blown away because the radiation pattern went right up the whip. I went halfway up the whip instead of being down by the ball. And then I, for over the period of a couple of months, I would go back and forth and compare with other amateurs, and they all said, absolutely, put the capacity hat back on.
Well, that's incredible. Yeah, you wonder about things like that. You know, you see those things, and then you think to yourself, do they really work? You know, but you don't know unless you have a chance to test. And you know, most people today, we don't have chances to test things like that. You know, you have to stand out with a fluorescent bulb or a field strength meter or something, you know, and play around. But it always, whenever you can do that, boy, does that open up the understanding, you know, kind of broadens your scope of your antenna theory.
Well, you know, the theory says it should elongate your radiation pattern, and I absolutely proved it, A, on the fluorescent tube, and B, by signal report. So that's what I do, and when I'm mobile, I really do. And I had the time. I was retired, and I played with this thing for months to different antennas. I said, I don't want a mechanical drive on my antenna. I just want it to work on all bands, and now I've got it.
So that's interesting, because most people depend on you know, a mechanical drive with a screwdriver antenna, and then there's other people that use the antenna tuners, those automatic antenna tuners. They mount them somewhere and, you know, run them up to a whip or some form of antenna, and of course they're limited then at that point to 100 watts or whatever the limit that tuner has, you know. And
I use the AH4 ICOM and automatic external antenna tuner with it, but it gives me I'm limited to 100 watts. That's the only thing, but that's all I can run in a car now at the moment anyway. So it makes me happy because I can bet up. My wife and I have gone on trips, and I if I don't like what's on 40, I can punch up something on 20 or 15 or 17. It doesn't matter. I don't have to stop driving the car to do it.
Well, you know, we went on a trip and it was a pickup truck, and we put 4 wooden poles in the back end of the pickup truck. They were about 6 feet tall, maybe 7, and put one in each corner of the truck bed. And we drilled holes in those things, and then we ran a piece of wire around them, like in a big, you know, like a big coil, basically, is what it was, about four four turns or something like that, and connected it to one of those automatic antenna tuners. This was the EDX-2 that Elinco makes. And we had an Elinco DX-70 in the truck cab. And that was one talking antenna. I mean, everybody was hearing us everywhere. And, I mean, great signal reports. And I wonder why we don't have antennas like that for mobile. You'd think that somebody would have, you know, made something like that. But and we just did it out of pure curiosity. I mean, there was no basis for building it in any way, shape, or form. We just thought, how would this work? You know, let's try this, you know.
It's trial and error. That's the fun part. One of the fun parts about the hobby, you get to tinker and you get to see what works. And that really makes, even so, since childhood, that's always been the fun part about it.
Well, let me ask you this question. Are you now, we've got a little bit of territory yet to cover. We've got your beginnings down. We know how you got here. But then the next question I have is, what you, I guess maybe the best thing to do at this point would be to go into the profession, and how do you think amateur radio affected your career working in the space industry?
It got me my job. I applied for my first job a week after I graduated from high school. I went over to a Teledyne, an aerospace company, and I said, "Do you have any jobs for technicians?" I wanted to get a job with summertime. I said, "Give me a job," and I pulled up my ham license, and he says, "You're hired." It was just that quick. He said, "If you know that, you know what we need to know for the job." And he took me in there, and they had an old assembly, because I went there because I looked at an industrial catalog, and they were building radios for the military. They had radio receivers and transmitters in their industrial catalog. I walked in there, and he showed me the radio equipment. He said, "This is the last production run. We're done with these. This is the end of our contract for radios, but what I want to hire you for is to work on MEMAs." I said, "What's a MEMA?" He says, "That's a microelectronic modular assembly." This is 1966. And I said, "Okay, tell me again, what's a MEMA?" He showed me this little thing. It's about the size of a quarter. And he says, "I want you to look in this microscope." And they had 25 integrated circuit dice mounted on there with bonded wires. These are microchip carriers, and there's 25 of them bonded together to make special circuits. And I said, "Really?" I says, "Yeah, it's for a digital computer that navigates aircraft for the military." I said, "What?" And so he said, let me show you what to do. And I wound up troubleshooting MEMAs, that is, microchips at that time, just for the dice, just the unmounted dice. They would mount a dice, but a flip-flop, for example, would go for about $50 in just parts size, one chip, one flip-flop, and then MEMA would have 25 different chips in there. My job as a technician, when one of these devices, the substrates, didn't work, is to troubleshoot and figure out which dice to unbond and rebond a new one, take it over to a lady that worked on a microscope and put a new chip down. So I couldn't stand it. I said, "Okay, I didn't know anything about the world of digital, but I was about to enter the world of digital in 1966 in microchips at that time." And so they gave me the schematic diagrams, the circuits for this thing, and I went home and studied it because they had an analog equivalent showing how you would build this with transistors and so on. And I studied it, and the next day I came back to work and says, "I understand it." And I became their ace troubleshooter for these things, and they started promoting me. So that by the time I was 19 years old, I had to move from Culver City out to Northridge, to the big facility in Northridge, and troubleshoot at the systems level, these computers that were the navigation computers for helicopters, for spacecraft they were building. It was the whole array of... We had a digital computer the size of a toaster. Most people couldn't even say the word computer. They did all that could picture is these big IBM mainframes. And I've got this thing the size of a toaster by putting these MEMAs into modules and submodules and making these computers for the military. That's what kind of where it got started with the big aerospace funding. And by the time I was 19 years old, I became the company's computer whiz kid. I had this amazing ability. I don't have it anymore. I wish I did. To memorize very complex schematics. I had photographic schematic diagram memory. And so they had me teaching a class on computer design at the age of 19. I would get up and fill an entire blackboard with logic diagrams, including module numbers, submodule numbers, and pin numbers on the OR gates and the NAND gates and the flip-flops, and explaining how it works. And I shall never forget We had a large array of students in my class. One of them was actually a retired Air Force colonel. And he stood up and he said, "I don't believe this. This is impossible." And he opened up the schematic and he said, "You've got everything right, including the pin numbers on the devices."
Wow.
That was my entry into the world of computers.
Well, now, how did that all fit into, how did it fit into the space program as you progressed working? What were the different things you were involved in, and how did what you'd learned, how did that incorporate itself into the rest of your career?
Well, that was the launch pad. That was aerospace. I became really the walking, talking encyclopedia of how their computers worked and how to fix them. I would go out on the test floor. At that time, if you remember the voyage to the bottom of the sea, and they had all these flashing lights, they were bit indicators for each of the shift registers inside the computers, and they had test programs. I would walk up and down the test floor, and somebody would have trouble with a computer, and I would watch how the lights blinked, and I would say, "You need to replace that AND gate on module so-and-so, sub-module so-and-so. Go ahead and look at pin number 3, because that's where your problem is." That was my next stage I reached at that particular job.
You're listening to QSO. Our guest today, Dale E. Winther, W6PDL. We'll be right back right after this. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you get a special bonus. You be sure and do that. Check out this little radio, the SkyWave from the Sea Crane Company. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Let's talk just for a moment about QSL cards. And let me tell you about Mr. QSL, call sign K4JSG. The world's finest QSL cards ever, guaranteed. Now, if you go up on this guy's website, you're going to find this note that says, please note, these are custom designed cards. If you're looking for a plain, ordinary, simple, basic, or any other word that's a synonym for boring, you'll be better off with a different card maker. Now, somebody make a statement like that, that should tell you something. The world's finest QSL cards ever, guaranteed, K4JSG. Go to Google. Go to Google, put in Mr. QSL. That's Mr. QSL. The very first listing will be Mr. QSL or K4JSG.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there, and other information, but go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSORadioShow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO, and it's all about ham radio. Let's return now to our guest, Dale E. Winther, W6PDL. So now, what were these things that you were working on? What functions did they perform, and how critical were they?
Well, for example, we're in the throes of the Vietnam War at the time, and the, trying to remember, the AH-14... I'm trying to remember the model number of the aircraft, the fighter jet. This is a complete navigation system for this military fighter jet. It could go hands-free. It would navigate the pilot. You could just say, take me to this latitude, longitude, and let go. This computer did all that.
My goodness. I guess I want to say, so if these things got messed up, what could happen?
Well, a plane could crash.
So this is controlling an aircraft that's manned, and the controlling circuits. Now, are the controlling any of these controlling circuits on the ground, or are these components that went into the aircraft?
They were all in the aircraft. I mean, the pilot could take over if something was wrong. It helped him navigate. It helped him get to his location. It was really for its day. It was a phenomenal achievement. The non-military person would have no idea that technology had advanced to such a level. And that put me right on the leading edge of computer technology right there. But another project we had was in getting in directly from there into the space program. The company had a contract for an inertial guidance system for a rocket, one of the Atlas Centaur rocket, which was called the Centaur computer, and it was an application they had for NASA, where they needed this computer to navigate that thing off the launch pad and up into space. And I became kind of the key man on that. In fact, here I was, and this was kind of a strange episode of my life. I was 20 years old, and they had a crisis out at Holloman Air Force Base where they were testing. They were using one of these computers on their first drone, And it turned out I was the most knowledgeable person the company had, this young 20-year-old kid, on exactly how that computer works. None of the engineers could figure out why that computer was failing on this Air Force drone. I didn't even know what I was in. I had to wait 6 months to get through my security clearance to get out there. They got me out there, and I went to a rent-a-car company, and they wouldn't rent me a car. They said, "You're too young to rent a car." I said, "But I'm needed on the Air Force base to solve this problem." And they just looked at me, "Sorry, kid, you can't rent a car from us." So I called my boss, and he called the CEO of I think it was Avis. And within 5 minutes, the gal's phone rang, and it was the CEO talking to the clerk and says, "You will rent Mr. Winther a car." So here's this 20-year-old who is not eligible to rent a car because I'm too young to drive. The insurance is not supposed to cover it, and I'm off to Holloman Air Force Base to solve the problem.
Very, very, very cool. Oh, but I bet that was frustrating standing there and the guy saying, nope, can't rent you a car. Can't do it.
Didn't like that. You were too young. Yeah, but I'm the one that's going to solve the problem.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. It really is. And, of course, when you run into situations like that, you get frustrated. You know, you think, well, what are they thinking? You know, of course, you know, once someone told them what to do, they knew what to do then. So did you figure it out? And just out of curiosity, what kind of drone was this?
This was a full-size jet. It was a jet that would normally have a man in it, but they were remote controlling the jet without a man in it.
Uh-huh. So this wasn't like what we're thinking about today when people talk about drones. This is an actual airplane, aircraft.
Well, what happened is that the thing wound up crashing on one of the city streets there in New Mexico, and the public didn't like that very much, and the military didn't want the public to see it.
Uh-huh. So, that craft, after it crashed, obviously was not recoverable.
No, but they wanted to know what the computer did wrong to make it crash, and that was where I came in to fix it. And I eventually found the problem. I mean, it was one of the milestones of my young 20-year-old age of my career.
Well, you know, you've been involved in this. I'll ask this question. What do you think about the situation where they're talking about automobiles navigating around town and going places and doing things like that without the driver driving, but a computer actually driving the car?
Absolutely nuts. I will say it again. That's absolutely nuts. I would never get in one.
Well, you know, it just seems to me that there's so many variables involved that I can't imagine a computer being able to keep up with all the variables that, you know, a driver can do. And even drivers, even human beings that are well-versed behind the wheel, that are not inebriated or anything else, they commit errors every once in a while, and it gets, you know, relatively dangerous and sometimes costs lives, you know. So I was wondering about that when they talk about this. I keep hearing that come up in conversations about computer-driven automobiles, you know, and I'm like, I don't know. Something about that just doesn't sound right.
Well, I could foresee that happening, let's say, on a freeway where you want to keep the distance between the cars to keep the traffic flowing, and as long as you didn't have any way for animals to get in front of you and people to get in front of you where it was a normal circumstance, I could see that. But in an area that's off the freeway, like here we live in a rural community where, you know, deer might jump out in front, I mean, what do you do? Sometimes it takes the human to have the judgment to figure out how to react, and no matter how many algorithms you produce, no matter how much software you write, you're not going to be as good as a human in a crisis.
Oh, see, that's kind of what I was thinking. It seems like getting inside of one of those cars is almost like asking for a freak accident of some sort. I don't know. Of course, now, you know, let me ask this question now. Where did you, I guess I want to say, were you more involved in writing a computer code? Were you more involved, like, in the hardware part of it, or all of it together, or what angle is it that you were the strongest at?
I was equally strong in both domains and in both domains simultaneously. I was the guy that came in when the engineers would point fingers and say, "Is it the hardware?" "No, it's the software." And I'd say, "Okay, I'll come in and I'll arbitrate."
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of wondered about that because it just seems to me that when you get into situations like what you're talking about, the code is as critical as the hardware.
Absolutely. My biggest claim to fame, and we'll move on to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, working there, is writing a firmware for spacecraft. And there, there's not much forgiveness there either. But I used to be. I can tell you that one of the spacecraft that was launched was going to be launched 2 weeks. We're 2 weeks from launch date, and it failed. And it was the people that worked on it, I think Ball Aerospace had worked on it, and JPL was just kind of managing the contract on that. And the original programmer had quit Ball Aerospace, and nobody quite knew how the code worked. It's called the flight software. It's all assembly language code. My expertise was in assembly language programming. And it failed in the test chamber. It turns out it worked. It failed when it was cold and in a vacuum. You had to have a vacuum, and you had to be cold, and you had to have them just at the right pressure and the right temperature, and that sucker would just fail. And we had 2 weeks to go to launch date, and they called me up in the middle of the night, and they said, Dale, I want you to get down here to the laboratory. We've got a crisis on our hands. We want you to see if you can fix this thing. So I spent all night and then the next 3 days, first of all, learning all of the software that this other individual had written. That's always fun, learning somebody else's code. And then learning the electronics that they had applied the software to. And then I walked into the lab and I said, I want you to instrument what we can instrument in the following test points. And we put on scopes and logic analyzers and the whole nine yards. And ran by the vacuum chamber and ran this thing down in temperature, and then we ran this down in pressure, and it would fail, and I would look at what was showing up on the oscilloscopes and the logic analyzers and record all that things down. And in about 3 hours, I located the problem. The problem was management didn't want to believe me because they said my answer was too pat. And I said, I'm sorry, that's really what's wrong. It took me another 2 or 3 days to convince management that I was right. Because, you see, the problem was inside the microprocessor chip itself. I said, well, that sounds like too easy of an answer. It's just changed the microprocessor. But that's what it was.
Wow. Yeah, but they're 2 weeks to launch time, and you're fishing for the... Oh, man. Doesn't that make a... put you under a lot of pressure?
It did. Those are the fun years. I have to tell you that working at JPL, I spent 20 years at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and this was like in the 70s and early 80s, and I'll give it a definition. It was Disneyland for engineers and scientists. Absolute Disneyland. If you were a creative, innovative person, you got to do anything you wanted. You got your choice of space project. Do you want to go to Mars with your next project? Do you want to go to Venus with your next project? We got to do it all.
That's amazing. So you made those choices. Which way were you leaning? Yeah, tell us about the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Well, I can't say how it is now. And then it was a bastion of creativity. I'm telling you, we had some of the best scientists and engineers, both old and new. And we saw problems. They said, I want to build an instrument that does this on the following, going to Mars. And when we get to Mars, I want it to do such and such. The scientists would get funding for the project. It was their job to get Congress to go along and say, okay, we'll fund this instrument on this spacecraft. And the engineers were to figure out how to build such a device and make it work and test it and make sure that it didn't fail as it went to the other planets. And but the point is, you had maximum creativity. You could dream up any scheme you wanted, and as long as it worked, they let you do it.
Well, let me ask you this question. Working in that kind of an environment, you know, a lot of folks would say, well, that's unrealistic because, you know, we have to stay on budget, and we have to do this, and we have to do that. But, you know, you're talking about an industry where you're creating things that... or creating things never been done before, extremely, totally, 100% cutting edge. In that environment, let me ask you this question. What is it that you saw, that you step back now and you look back on all that, what is it that fosters creativity, and what is it that kills creativity?
Boy, that's a good one. What fosters creativity is an environment where there's no serious time pressure, there's no political pressure. You can just sit back and say, tell me, you as an individual, how would you solve this problem and how can we do that? And you're just left alone to do it. That really is the proper environment for creativity in engineering or probably any other creative field. And if we get into a situation where, you know, you got to get it done in 30 days, no matter what it takes, you got to get it done, and you, and it's gonna, if you run over budget, we're gonna, we, you're gonna lose your job, we're gonna fire you, and that, which you get in a lot of commercial areas, and that's the difference. And I think that that was a real great episode in American history, because we were able to take some of the brightest and the most creative people and put them all together and conquer space. That's really what happened, and it saddens me that that's gone now, because it was a terrific time in our history.
Well, you mentioned one of the things you, I heard you say, you know, of course, we talked about budgetary things, but you said there was no political interference. Now, have you, how does that work? I mean, if you weren't, if you didn't, how do they keep political interference out of the way? It seems like everywhere I look, there's political interference with something.
Well, it's interesting the way the lab was set up. You have section managers and you have group managers. There's always some politics. It's human nature. But, for example, you go into a meeting with a group of engineers and scientists, and they all have the same goal. They want to achieve the following, and you have all these people with different levels of experience and different expertise, and they all talk about their areas, and we cooperate. It's the greatest. I must say it was the greatest position of human cooperation I've ever experienced in my lifetime, because everybody cooperated. There was no, you know, if I stabbed this guy in the back, I might get more money, or I might get more stock, or whatever. None of this existed. Everybody worked together for a common goal. It's just the way it worked.
Well, what was, you know, tell us a little bit about more on the line of what other projects you worked on there at JPL, and when what did you get exposed to, and did you ever get exposed to something that was top secret that you couldn't talk about?
During the time I was in the lab, the people were very reticent. It was right after the Vietnam War, and young engineers didn't want to have anything to do with any top secret military projects. I did get involved in one secret project that was a joint NASA joint Air Force project. It was a satellite that we both shared and both shared the expense on. I was very heavily involved in that, so I had to get my second secret clearance. I had one previously and it had lapsed, and they had to get me another security clearance on that one. It wasn't anything nefarious, but because the Air Force is involved, why we had to do that. It was kind of interesting because we would have meetings with the department, with the Air Force back at the Pentagon by two-way television. We had a big room. That was when everything was satellite and direct satellite. There was no internet. And we had this big dish on top of this one conference room, which was a direct uplink to a satellite. And, you know, that's expensive communication time. Sit around the table and we'd all talk. We'd pass along the joystick to zoom in on the different officers at the Pentagon. I could zoom in on a colonel or a major, whoever's sitting there, and point the camera right at them, and they could do the same with us. That was kind of an interesting way to communicate.
I see. Did you? I guess I want to say that the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Why don't you tell us a little bit about all the things that they were developing or all the things they were involved in that folks might be able to recall or be familiar with?
Oh, let me see if I can down the list. Before I do that, I want to show you the niftiest thing. When my first project in the early 70s was the Viking lander. The Vikings, people don't realize that the Viking landed on Mars. It was the first large spacecraft, fully automatic, successful landing on Mars. It was phenomenal. And I'll never forget years of disappointment that the public just didn't seem to know hardly anything about it. Our media was so poor at covering such a achievement. It was the greatest achievement in space since the moon landing, as far as landings were concerned. I was fortunate to work on that, and that was my first project on the Mars atmosphere water detector. It was a combination lander and orbiter, and the Mars atmosphere water detector stayed in orbit and it used looked through the atmosphere to see how much moisture content was in the atmosphere optically. That was kind of the first thing I did. But the reason I say that is the biggest treat I had was that if you remember when in Star Trek, when they were going to approach another planet, and you'd see the planet outside the window of the Enterprise, it would get bigger and bigger and bigger as it got closer to approaching the planet. Well, as the Viking spacecraft was approaching Mars for its landing, we got to see that in our cafeteria. All the monitors in the cafeteria were live, online, watching the final approach of the planet. It was just absolutely amazing.
Now, the Viking lander, okay, so let me ask you this question. What was it about that thing that you designed or were part of, and how did that work?
That was my first project that worked, and I did on the device. It had already launched when I. It had not launched yet. I worked on the ground support equipment for that one. We had this huge three racks. So there were 6 or 7 feet tall, full of circuits and full of. And we used a Varian, a 620i mini computer to control it. And my first job at JPL, I think it was 1975, and it was to write the software that did the testing on the instrument. So we had to use that mini computer to connect up to the same port on the instrument that it would on the spacecraft and make sure everything worked right.
I'm curious about this, though. On all this stuff that you worked on, all these different computers, what operating system did they use, or did you folks create your own?
Well, I virtually created our own. I've never heard of an operating system until the early PCs. We just did what you did. I created, for example, my big achievement was really the operating system for the Hubble Space Telescope, for the camera portion itself. I actually designed the onboard hardware, the electronics for the camera portion, and software, and an operating system that we could load up to and operate the Hubble Space Telescope.
Goodness. Well, you know, I hear people say things like, well, in applications like that, you find a lot of Linux operating, you know, and or Unix. And I was curious, does what you were using, was it any kin to that, or did it operate anywhere near that, or is it a completely different form of operating system?
Well, in reality, it really wasn't an operating system. It was just hard-coded. It was hard-coded firmware that did the task. There really, at that stage, we didn't need any operating systems.
Okay, so you weren't working with like a... you know, a computer CPU and then having different forms of input and output. You had basically, direct programming, whatever that is, directly into whatever the processors are that you're using to do the things you're doing.
Okay, we use an RCA 1801 microprocessor to do the job. In fact, I was kind of one of the instrumental people in getting JPL to start using microprocessors. Before that, they had used the support equipment for doing ground support equipment that allows you to test and operate the spacecraft on the ground before you put it up in space. Were built with racks and racks of discrete electronic components. They were big, they were bulky, and they had to be hand wired, and you had a lot of problem getting them up and running. So when the microprocessor era began, I said, I can take, and I did this on the Pioneer Venus spacecraft. We were sending a spacecraft to Venus, so it's called the Pioneer. And they asked for my input on how we were going to design the ground support test equipment for that. I said, let's use one of these new 1801 microprocessors. And so I took and reduced a 6-foot rack into something about the size of a bread box and did it all with firmware and a microprocessor. And management looked at that and says, our next two major projects, the Hubble and the Galileo, we should probably use that microprocessor to do that. So I was kind of instrumental in kicking off that technology within the space.
Let's go. Well, let me ask you this question now. What all can the space telescope do by means of the things that you designed for it?
Well, what I designed for the portion that I was responsible for was really doing the camera itself, the imaging itself, the timing, the timing pulses for the CCD imaging, and the telemetry for the imaging, and the control of the imaging, and the control of the filter stepper, and all of the things that directly get involved with taking the picture.
So, let me ask this question. Once that thing is pointed at an object, and you've got it, you've oriented the telescope, and you're looking at what you're looking at, and these awesome photos that we see, which I realize some of them, or maybe a lot of them, are time exposures.
I got to see them before you did.
Okay. But how do you get that picture here? What is it that transfers that incredible picture to us here on Earth where we can see these things?
It's just sent it out by digital encoded microwave.
See, I ask a question like that, and he gives me just it's simple.
Hey,
just,
no problem. You just send out some bits.
Well, okay, now, I'm just curious, how many of those pictures are time exposures as opposed to real time?
Well, they've been operating for so many years, and there's the ability to run hours of exposure. As long as you can keep that camera stable in space, you can go for hours. So, yeah, everything from microseconds to hours and minutes.
Well, I was just curious what it looks like through the Hubble telescope when you're not in a time exposure mode. I mean, is it less dramatic, or does it look, or is it still real dramatic regardless?
depends. Now, what makes it so dramatic, if you're looking, like, example, with the clusters of, you know, the really amazing people that people have seen is the birth of stars, a big cluster of, looks like colored gas way out in the universe. These are long time exposures because, remember, the farther out the stars are, the weaker the light. So the way the CCD works is the more exposure you have, the more energy it can convert, and more photon energy it can convert into electric current. So it's just a matter of how far you want to look into space. If you look close by, you want a short exposure. If you want to look way far out there, the stars that you can't normally see with the naked eye or even with a large terrestrial telescope, then you have to use the long-time exposure.
I'm just curious as to what detail can you get, let's say, in real time, looking at the moon through the Hubble?
Oh, it practically blinds the Hubble. You've got to have a short exposure.
Well, the reason why I say that is because it just seems like you could probably see a mission on the moon from I would think you'd probably be able to see people walking around.
Well, you probably could, but as I recall, the optics aren't designed for anything that close, so I suspect it would just be a big blur if you pointed the Hubble at the moon.
I didn't know. Now, where is the location at, or is there multiple locations where the access to the Hubble is, where people actually, you know, that are working the telescope and are doing all the functions? Where is that?
I don't recall. I don't know where it is now. Initially, I think they were operating it out of Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, but that's been a while, so I haven't kept tabs on it.
I was just curious. I didn't know if you'd ever been in the actual control room, or if you'd actually been able to actually sit down and maybe, you know, guide the thing and look at it and all that kind of thing, or if it's, you know, or if that's just a highly secured thing or something.
No, we just handed it off to the scientists at the other facilities and went on to other projects.
But you actually got to be able to look through it, or look at the images coming down from it, and do a little, I guess I want to say, playing or tinkering with it.
I didn't do any tinkering, but we had the advantage of when some of the first spectacular photos came in, they were like plastered in the hallways at JPL, and everybody could walk in their office and go, ooh, ah, as you walk down the hall to your office.
Well, that must have been cool. I just can't imagine. You know right now, there's places that actually rent time on terrestrial telescopes. You can lease a telescope, you know, and then you do everything by means of the Internet. But with HD video and all that kind of thing, those are pretty spectacular. There's some pretty large scopes on the ground. Of course, it's all weather driven. If you have clouds in the sky, you don't get to see anything, you know. But there's a lot of folks doing that, and I can understand why, because I've got two telescopes. The one is a 10, and the other one's an 8-inch. But they're a little bit monstrous, you know, carrying outside and carrying back in and all that. And friends of mine had a 16-inch reflector, and that was like having a pet elephant, you know. I mean, it was it's just a lot. So the thought had just crossed my mind. I wonder what it would be like. Just like I wonder what it would be like to stare through and be able to navigate the telescope at Yerkes, or the telescope at Mount Palomar. You know, those things, of course, that's all we had. The Hubble, though, when the Hubble came out, it was like, you know, it was like the ultimate telescope ever, period, you know. And who knows, maybe. You think they'll ever develop another one, maybe another telescope, either bigger or than the Hubble, or do you think this is it for now?
They're working on something else. I haven't followed what it is they're doing, but if there will be another replacement for that. I don't know when it's going to be. Like I said, I haven't kept tabs on it, but this is too good a science. I mean, the whole world knows about this one. It's really been a spectacular. But I got to say, the thing that really gives me a sense of pride was the Galileo spacecraft that went to Jupiter. I was the designer on the imaging system for that as well. That is actually the spacecraft where we first used microprocessors on it. They were distributed microprocessors with that RCA processor. And the way they decided to do it is to make a bus and make every single science instrument on the spacecraft have their own microprocessor, and then it would be a central processor in the middle, so we distributed all the computing power at that time. And I was very instrumental in getting the microprocessor into the Galileo and designing the camera systems on the Galileo that I don't even recall that, but it lasted for years and years and years, and it got to the point where Congress said shut it down because we can't afford to process the data anymore.
Oh, my goodness. Well, what did it wind up? I'm trying to think Galileo. I'm trying to connect the dots here. What was it that the Galileo was giving us pictures of? And I know this went on for a while.
Pizza. That's a funny comment. You remember it went on and orbited the Jupiter and the moons and got close up pictures of all the moons. And in one of the pictures, one of the scientists, I'm trying to remember what his name was. One of the famous ones that died, you probably had the TV series, was at JPL at the time looking at the pictures, kind of looking at one of the moons, I think it was Io, and he says, oh my God, he says, look at the close-up at that moon, it looks just like a pizza.
Yeah, I was wondering what you were talking about. I thought, pizza, okay. Well, you know, they say that there's a face on Mars, you know, that fellow from... what's his name? Richard Hoagland.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy.
Yeah, and he's got all sorts of stories about NASA and the face on Mars and things on the moon, and I think you kind of wonder, you know, you can sit back and think, I don't know, I mean, what if he's right? You know, what if that really is a face? You know, but you know, I don't know. I mean, you're able to see probably. You know, pictures and things that come back from different places. I would have bet that the fellows that get these pictures in probably put them up on the wall, and I would imagine people can see other all kinds of things. I mean, you know, you might see something in a picture that looks like a Coke bottle, you know. you guys ever do that, though? You put pictures up and say, look at that. That looks just like so-and-so or something. I mean, or is that just a... I don't know. I couldn't help doing that, I guess, if I had access to pictures like that. I'd be looking and, you know, trying to... Because, you know, if you point out a picture, you point out... Oh, well, better yet, have you ever seen an anomaly like that you really thought might be real?
I don't think I have. In fact, my first encounter with Richard Hoagland was... I was still working at JPL, and I went to work one day, and there was a big picket line. It was about his face on Mars. I'd never heard this story that there was supposed to be a face on Mars. And there was a big picket line where I was trying to pull in. I thought, what are these kooks doing here? So that was my first experience to that whole thing. I really can't tell you. I'm kind of open-minded. I think that, amazing or remarkable claims require remarkable evidence. That's the way science works. I don't like the if people withhold evidence, I don't like that, and I don't like pseudoscience where people make claims that can't be proven. So we just have to wait and see.
Yeah, you know, there's all kinds of things that happen. You know, I've seen, I don't know, there have been several places that I was visiting in a rock formation, you know, going up the side of a hill was a perfect face, you know. And but yet it hadn't been carved by anybody. It was just an anomaly, you know. And the same thing I've seen where people have shown you faces in trees, you know, that you could see. And it was like kind of give you the willies looking at it, you know. But nonetheless, it just was. I mean, there wasn't anything significant about it. It just that's the way it was. So now I've wondered about that. And I was thinking somebody who works for Jet Propulsion Laboratories, you probably get to see all these pictures of different things. So I wondered if. You know, if you'd ever seen like a, you know, McDonald's hamburger on a planet somewhere or or floating in space or anything like that, because Hoagland talks about all sorts of objects on the moon, you know, that and he gets kind of accusatory. He says that NASA has erased a lot of that stuff. You know, the film has been erased and all this. So it does makes you wonder a little bit, you know. Is it?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of his commentary on. I've changed rooms. If I have a bad echo, let me know and I'll move.
Well, now I want to talk to you now. I want to change gears here real quick, and I want to talk to you now and go into some detail on this, and that is you are an author.
Absolutely. I've written a book, and that was one of my on my to-do list since I was a child, and I finally got retired and had time to do it.
Okay, now if we go to your website... it says watch my video, but there's a bunch of different like videos there. Now,
yeah, don't go to that one. Don't go. Just go directly to www.thebrotherhoodofthebeast.com.
Okay.
But don't take it from my website. Take it right from your internet prompt.
Okay. Brotherhood of the Beast, the Brotherhood.
The Brotherhood of the Beast.com.
All right. Now tell us a little bit about this.
Well, let me tell you what happened there is after I got out of the workforce, I started watching TV and listening to talk radio and reading, and I was just absolutely horrified that this is no longer the world I thought I lived in. And so a lot of people can relate to that. How things have changed since the 1970s, you know, that much. I told you what my career has been like. It's been spectacular. And I realized that the media was not telling anybody about the important stories. It's all fluff stories for the most part. People are just not hearing what's really important. And I'm being an analytical person. I'm analyzing this stuff. And I just can't believe that, you know, what's going on. It's like listen to radio and TV. Remember, I had worked very intensely for, you know, very long hours and never paid any attention to the social environment or the culture. It was all technical for me. I'm in the truest of the word, an engineer type person. And I had time on my hands, and I thought I had just woken up to discover that we're in the twilight zone. What in the world are these people doing? You know, and what do you mean we're not a great nation, and we're not, you know, special? Yeah, we are, because in my childhood, it was the greatness of our nation and our motives and our desires to make things good and have good science and do good things that drove my entire life. And suddenly it's like you watch our media and say, wow, this is crazy stuff. So I thought, well, if I'm going to write a book, let me do something about that. Now, I've always been a good storyteller, so I thought, all right, why don't I write a story that will keep people intrigued and kind of a thriller, but at the same time, educate them a bit. So I started to work on it, and what had happened is I wound up on talking on the repeater here, local repeater, which is the W6WGZ repeater out of Madera. And I ran into an 82-year-old man. He's K6NOQ, K6NOQ on the 2-meter repeater. And he turns out he is a New York fashion photographer. He's long retired. He was a famous fashion photographer. He was on Vogue and Life and several Levine covers there. And then he took up a second career as a screenplay writer, Hollywood screenplay writer. And like myself, he was also a private pilot. I'm a pilot as well. And so he said, look, we're going to get you to finish this book. We're going to get it done right. We're going to get it published, and let me help you do that. And he would leave me alone every time I turn on the radio. How's the book coming? How's the book coming? How's the book coming? So we had a monthly meeting at the Black Bear Diner in Madera, California, and we all became members of the Flying Hams Radio Club. You're going to love that title.
Yeah.
And that what it was, to be a member of that that writer's club, you had to be a pilot, a ham, and a writer. And everybody was.
Goodness.
Yeah, so we were with the Flying Hams Radio Club. And what we did is we wrote manuscripts, and everybody reviewed everybody's work. We took turns. They would take the latest section of my manuscript, and they would pick it apart and, you know, and say, you've got to change this, or I don't understand that sort of thing. So that kind of got me into it, and so now, as a matter of pride, I simply had to finish this book. So, and the idea was to tell the story from my understanding of our technology, and I understand it pretty well, especially in the computer domains, where we're at, what can and can't go wrong, and my observation of what's happened in our society, in our culture, with all the corruption that's taking place that we see that just makes you sick. And the tyranny that goes on, and this big push for world government you keep hearing about. And I said, why don't I write that into a thriller where we take our existing state-of-the-art technology and move it forward into the future just a little bit and build a story around people that have to live in that period. Maybe it's 5 years from now, but if things go terribly wrong, what could happen? And that's exactly what I did. It's really only science fiction because the setting is in the future, but most of the information in the book that I draw upon is current science fact, like the drone technologies and that sort of thing. So what I did is I said the story is based on real technologies, financial and political circumstances that are currently in place and are documented at the end of the book. So here I am with a science fiction thriller that's mostly fact and annotated and documented in the book where the facts come from. So that right away was kind of a novel. Kind of give my publisher a start. Well, is it a science fiction or not? I said, no, it's real facts, but it's a fun way to present it. So that's what he did there. So what I'd like to do, Ted, for you is I've got three little readings that I'd like to do from the book about ham radio and how it gets involved in the story.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, I'd like to hear this.
Okay. And first of all, I'll make a reference to my documentation in the back of the book, and this is about the end of ham radio. Now, and this is how it happens. This is how it actually can happen. On July 6, 2012, the president signed Executive Order 13618, authorizing the deactivation or closing of radio stations, services, and facilities during a national emergency. All entities licensed or regulated by the Federal Communications Commission were subject to government seizure or shutdown. The act was used to disable all cellular phones, broadcast radio and TV stations, ham radio stations, and all other forms of two-way radio communications. This directly does spring from Executive Order 1368, which was signed, in fact, in 2012. So it sets the stage for this to start happening, to shutting down ham radio. So that
actually is law that has been enacted, and it stands on the books currently.
Absolutely. So here's what happens with this law in the near future. As a quote from the book, I'll read you that. By the order of the Homeland Security, the Internet has been deemed unsafe. You will only be allowed to access banking institutions to maintain vital economic activity. The government is completing a new internet system that should be operating sometime next month. Pandemonium broke out. Online buying and selling, along with all independent news reporting, was no longer possible. Email traffic was halted. The public could not get news or even communicate with friends. Homeland Security shut down all broadcast radio, TV, and cellular phones. Rumors of military convoys headed into large cities were causing widespread panic. Amateur radio operators were able to get some news out to the public before the military clamped down on all forms of private radio communication. Many of them had shortwave communications capability that enabled them to talk around the world. That was truly a disturbing situation for the government. The hobbyists also had terrestrial coast-to-coast communication networks that used mountaintop-to-mountaintop radio relay stations. These radio systems could be used to inform the public and coordinate citizen resistance. Thousands of hams hid their radio equipment to prevent seizure. Everyone that possessed an amateur radio license received a knock at their door. If they had an antenna outside and had no radios, it was assumed that they were hiding equipment. They were arrested. Hams that had more than one radio set aside, left at least one out to be taken. They stayed out of jail, but retained what would later become a critical lifeline for humanity. A new executive order was issued that gave the police and the military the authority to shoot any private citizen seen using a two-way radio. Only police, firemen, and authorized government agents were exempt. That was the first little read there.
Wow.
That's how they shut down Ham Radio America.
Well, let me ask you a question now. You know, we were talking earlier, and you said, well, you know, things are just, you know, the way things have gotten since the 70s, things have really, really changed. In your mind, do you see the possibility, or I guess I don't want to say not just the possibility, in your mind, do you see this happening someday?
You know, I see it's a possibility. How far will it go, and will it happen? I do see that it's a possibility if we continue down the path we're on. What I'm trying to do is say, here are the facts, both political, social, financial, and technical, that open the door for this to happen. Nobody can tell the future. I wish I could. I'd be rich and famous. But it is a possibility, and it's the kinds of things that because it's possible, it's like it's also very possible that someday someone will set off a nuclear bomb in a populated area. That's a possibility, too. But these are things we have to guard against as citizens of the world.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, I guess the way I look at it is that amateur radio is in a position to where if we did have some horrible thing happen, amateur radio is there and could be an absolute godsend as far as communications ability in a bad situation, you know. Providing we wind up keeping the service long enough to where we would still be active if something were to happen. I don't. Does that make any sense at all?
That's absolutely critical. I can remember some years ago when the internet boom started. They started doing the DSL and fiber and all the ways of distributing the internet. That some company was talking about sending internet data over the power lines, and I raised all holy heck. I told one guy who was going to make an investment. And I says, "Don't you do it?" I says, "It's not going to happen." I says, "You know, realize that if they start sending digital data over power lines, it's the end for HF radio." And I explained to him what could happen if we lost that capability. So we have to stand guard over that sort of thing.
Well, I guess the thing of it is that you know, organizations, of course, in our situation, I guess there's only one, and that's the ARRL, can stay focused on that sort of thing and kind of leave the politics behind. And put politics in the area that it belongs, and then concentrate the focus on preserving this hobby and keeping the hobby going so that it is around for multiple generations. And if we ever got to a point where, you know, you even think about the natural disasters that can take place. I mean, I sit and, you know, I think about that Hubble telescope up there, and I think, you know, it's any day something could come out of space somewhere and just slam into that thing. You know, I mean, like, you wonder about stuff like that. There's no way to predict it. I mean, I know now they have methods of telling us when an object is going to come near the Earth and all that, but there's still, you know, it's still like up for grabs. I mean, you wake up in the morning, you don't know what could come out of space that nobody even notices, you know, and that could be the end of all of it, or it could very, very severely hamper life as we know it. And you know what? We may be left with an infrastructure that just consists of a bunch of guys with ham radios.
Well, that's exactly right. And that is why I try to get in. I have two more little reads to give you that will actually clarify that for people. Let me proceed with that.
All right.
The next one, a quote from the book, is really the seizure of American guns and what happens during this whole process. Talking about a young man in a southern city. He decided to turn on his shortwave radio since it was sometimes possible to hear information that was not filtered and cleared by GEO. GEO is my term of the new global government called GEO. Just owning a shortwave receiver is a crime. His grandfather gave it to him before he died and told him not to tell anyone about it. When David did not know what David did not know was that the military assault drone was in the area to prepare for the next stage of the war against the rebel gun owners of Virginia. The UN forces were advancing toward them like a wave of army ants. The beast was determined to make America a gun-free country, even if they had to kill half of the population. But the pushback from the Texans and the Southerners would prove to be especially ferocious. That night, David connected a long piece of wire to the shortwave radio to act as a receiving antenna. Ideally, he should string the wire outside, but someone might see it. He was able to get a pretty good reception by running the wire through their attic. The attic door was in his room, so he could just pull the end down to connect it at night and put it back up before going to sleep. He told his mother that he was going to go to bed early, but that wasn't quite true. David attached a set of headphones to the radio and twisted the dial until he heard something. What he heard was devastating. Reports of death and mayhem were coming in as the gun war was spreading across the country. "Someone help me. I can see them coming for me. Oh, my God, they shot me." It was the last thing that David heard from an Arizona ham radio operator. He had listened to his shortwave for several nights and recorded dozens of such events on his MP3 sound recorder. Finally, the 14-year-old turned off his radio, went to bed, and cried himself to sleep.
There you go. That's you're painting a picture. I guess you have one more read, though, you said.
Yes.
All right, let's hear that one, unless you have something to say about this one right now.
No, but you get the picture from that one, what happens when we have true tyranny taking over on a global basis.
Oh, yeah. That's, I
they
mean,
want
that's
our
like,
guns, baby. They want our guns.
That's scary. It's really scary.
It's really scary. A lot of hands are talking about these things around the country right as we sit. Anyway, this one I want to explain a precursor to it. There are brilliant children are taken from their parents and sent to live in a government camp to be educated. They are used to advance science and medicine, but only for the elites. These children are called the specials. Specials are a group of kids that are at genius level, and they just simply take them from their parents and train them. So they want the technology that they can produce for themselves. Anyway, from the book, from the storyline in the book, Jim and his friend in Oregon had long ago agreed that if one of them escaped their special camp, they would listen to a specific amateur radio shortwave frequency every Friday night at midnight Eastern time. That way, the escaped special, that's one of the kids from the camp, had a way to contact the other one. The resistance had ham radio units just for such emergencies. They never used them because Homeland Security would instantly track them down by getting a fix on their transmission. Wait a minute. Pages here. Hold on a minute. I've got two pages stuck together. Hang on.
All right. I hate that. You know.
All right, here we go. They're just sticking together. All right. We got it. The next page. These radios can communicate over thousands of miles. No need for the internet. No need for a satellite link. Just don't stick around very long after you transmit. Jim went out after dark Friday and carried a radio unit, a makeshift antenna, and a large battery to a remote location to avoid being observed by satellites or drones. He knew that if his friend answered his midnight radio call, it could be a death sentence for him. Jim had no choice. The lives of billions were at stake. He called his friend on the predetermined shortwave radio frequency. He kept calling him over and over for 10 minutes. The young men made up radio call signs. Jim was S1 for Special 1. His friend in Oregon was S2. S2, this is S1. S2, this is S1. Do you hear me? It seemed like Jim was calling for an eternity. Over and over, Jim called S1. This is S2, this is S1. Please come back. By this time, Homeland Security would have already obtained a fix on his position. After 9 minutes of calling, his friend answered. Jim explained the need to stop the mass death weapons from triggering. Is there a way to do this without the cell phone codes? Jim could already hear the approaching drones that were dispatched to kill him. He struggled with fear as the killing machines got closer and closer. But he had to wait for S2's answer. The shortwave radio signal was weak and it began to fade out, just as S2 was explaining to Jim what to do. Repeat, repeat. Over and over, Jim cried into the radio microphone for his friend to repeat the answer. All Jim could hear was hissing and static. Suddenly, the signal gained strength, and Jim was able to understand his friend's message from Oregon. He was now shaking in terror as the drone engines were getting quite loud. S2 told Jim that there was a simple way to do it. The conversation only lasted for 2 minutes. Before his friend was silenced at the Oregon special camp. Homeland Security had quickly located his transmitter. A drone was launching a missile at Jim as he ran quickly behind a nearby rock outcropping. The radio was blasted into a million pieces, but Jim survived. He stayed hidden from the search drone's infrared cameras until just before sunrise, when they gave up their search. Quickly, Jim made it back to safety of the resistance hideout. And there you have it.
Oh, boy. Somebody's going to want to buy a book now.
I hope so.
Yeah. So where is the book available?
You can get it from Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com and also from my publisher, TatePublishing.com. You can get it there as well. Or the easiest thing first is just to look at www.thebrotherhoodofthebeast.com, brotherhoodofthebeast.com, and see all about it and decide whether you want to buy it from the publisher or from Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Thebrotherhoodofthebeast.com. That's the
right.
That's the website we want to...
That's the key to the whole thing.
Well, I'll tell you what, just what you were reading to me. I know the Pope folks were probably riveted to their chairs. Yeah, saying more, what's the chances of this thing getting made into a movie, possibly?
I don't know, but it's interesting that one of the first person to comment on the book was a Hollywood movie producer, so I'm crossing my fingers.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. In audiobook form, this thing would just be an incredible thing for folks that don't have you know, the time to sit down and read. And I mean, there's folks suffering from that today, I know for a fact. But it's like I do a lot of audiobook listening, so you gotta be thinking about that, you know, about getting this thing in audiobook form.
You know, I gotta figure out how to do that. Right now, the publisher isn't doing that, but I think in the future we can do that. I've already had requests from people on the QRZ site saying, "Do you have an audiobook?" So I can see that there's a desire.
Well, I think a lot of it is just the fact that folks are pressed for time, but they can listen going down the road. You know, they can listen in the car. They can listen, you know, with an MP3 player when they're waiting somewhere in a doctor's office or for an appointment or something. You know, so they have the opportunity to listen where you couldn't necessarily maybe hold a book. Listen, we are out of time, and I want to say thank you so much for coming on board with us. This has been an incredible interview. It's not too often I talk to folks that have all these different things going on and can talk about so many different things. And so we're going to have to...
I have a lot more I didn't have time to say, but I've had fun talking.
I'll tell you what, then. What we're going to have to do is we'll just have to have you back. How does that sound?
That could work, too. I can keep on going, Ted.
Well, we can we can do that. We can schedule another QSO. I'd love to do that. And, you know, we can cover all the areas that you thought you might want to cover, but we didn't have time to. But I thank you much. I appreciate your time, and 73 to you, and thank you for coming on board.
Okay, 73 is Ted, and everybody listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to QSO, and we're sorry, but we're just out of time. We'll be back next week, same time, same station, 1 p.m. on 9475 on WTWW, Sunday nights, 7 p.m. on 5085. All times are Central Daylight Times. Be sure to go to the website, qsoradioshow.com. Thank you for listening.